Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Last week, lawyers for Facebook, Google, and Twitter testified before Senate subcommittee looking into Russian-backed attempts to influence the 2016 presidential election. All told, Russian disinformation posts reached 126 million people on Facebook and 20 million people on Instagram, the executive said. Joining us now by phone to discuss and recap the exchange as far as the tech industry's response to the Russian campaigns is tech writer for Slate, Will Oramus. He has a new podcast out. It's called If Then. It's from Slate. You can get it at the usual places. Welcome back, Will.
Thanks for having me, Ann.
These tech companies sent lawyers instead of their top executives to the hearing. What does that suggest to you?
Yeah, I mean, I think it can suggest one of two things. One possibility that a lot of people are taking from it is that they're still not taking this seriously enough. They still think that this is a sort of low-level issue where their CEOs can kind of stay above the fray and not get into the weeds of what happened with Russian meddling in the election. So I think some members of Congress probably took it as an insult that folks like Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook, Jack Dorsey of Twitter, and Sundar Pichai of Google were not there. I think probably a bigger reason, actually, was that they sent lawyers because they didn't want to say the wrong thing. This is extremely legally sensitive for them. They're facing potentially legislation that could affect their businesses in profound ways. They don't want to send an executive up there who's going to say something controversial. Frankly, they don't want to say anything too substantive. They need people who are skilled professionals at not disclosing anything that they're not supposed to disclose, and that's why they sent their general counsel to these hearings.
I mean, is it fair to say they probably talked to each other about who they were going to send since they all sent the same thing? Nobody?
Yeah, I don't know if they talked to each other in advance or if it was just that, you know, one of them said, well, we'll send our general counsel, and then the others said, we'll do the same. Mm-hmm. Google was actually the last of the three to agree to the hearings. Facebook and Twitter agreed early on. And this is an interesting side note. You actually got the sense from Google throughout the hearings that they didn't think they should be there. You know, it's like the kid who thinks that he doesn't deserve to be in trouble with the other two kids. Mm-hmm. Because Google was trying to distance itself from social networks and social media, saying, well, we're really about search and we're not involved in these viral Russian posts. But that's actually not true because they own YouTube, and there were fake news posts and propaganda going around on YouTube as well.
I wanted to know how Google, Facebook, and Twitter services were used by Russian groups. So let's start with Google. It would seem likely to me that they probably paid for ad placement or for placement in the search.
You know, yeah. So we don't have full clarity on exactly how Google ads were used. We do know that there were some Google ads placed by some of these groups, like the Internet Research Agency, which is this Kremlin-linked group of trolls and hackers in Russia. What we do know is that, and an interesting gray area here, is that Google's YouTube video service is used very skillfully, in fact, by RT, Russia Today, which is the state-affiliated Russian media conglomerate. It has a very large channel on YouTube and lots of followers. It's very influential. And one of the questions that came up in the hearing was, look, you know, we're talking about some of these tech companies taking money in advertisements from Russians who are meddling in the election. But this is actually a two-way street, at least in Google's case, because when RT posts videos on Google, there's a revenue-sharing agreement, and Google's actually sending money to RT. So some of the members of Congress were not thoroughly pleased with the idea that an American company is actually funneling money back to the Kremlin to help with these efforts.
But what about Facebook and Twitter, the social media biggies?
Yeah, so Facebook was really the biggest place where Russians were able to make their influence felt on the U.S. election. One of the interesting things we learned from these hearings was, you know, we sort of had the idea when Facebook first disclosed a few months ago that Russian hackers or trolls had posted ads on Facebook related to the U.S. election. Some people may have had in mind the sort of election ads that we're used to on TV, where it's, you know, knocking one candidate or supporting another candidate.
And they're obviously ads. Yeah.
And they're obviously ads, exactly. And we now know that what these ads looked like was something very different. What they really looked like was Facebook posts. These are pieces of content. They're memes or they're posts by a page that people follow, or they're even article pages that are being posted on Facebook and then shared around. And the part of it that's the ad is that the pages, so some of these Russian-created pages, were paying to show these posts to more people. Mm-hmm. But they don't look like ads. They look like content. And another thing we learned from the hearings is that these were not always overt candidate-related ads. A lot of times, they were Russian groups posing as American activists on both sides of the political divide. So you had, for instance, one of the things that came out in the second day of the hearings was there was a group called Heart of Texas, which was actually, it purported to be the sort of patriotic, pro-Texas, right-leaning activist group. In fact, it was run entirely by Russians, as far as we now know. And they staged a rally in Houston against the, quote, Islamization of Texas.
Oh,
so they were
right,
getting
yeah.
Texans riled up against mm-hmm. the idea that Muslims are taking over their state. At the same time, there was another Russian-backed Facebook group that was called United Muslims of America that was purporting to be a Muslim American group, and they promoted an event at the same time, at the same place, aimed at, quote, saving Islamic knowledge. So, and what happened was real people, real Texans, turned out to both of these events, protesting each other at the same spot. There was even some skirmishes that broke out, and these rallies had been planned entirely from Russia. So the goal was not just to promote Donald Trump or hurt Hillary Clinton. The goal was, in fact, to turn Americans against each other and play on our political divide.
So when I ask this question, if there's any way to measure if the Russian-backed campaigns actually made a difference at the polls, it's kind of hard to say. I mean, it did succeed in turning Americans against each other through completely false pretenses.
Right. So the really tough question that I don't think we'll ever be able to answer was, did Russian meddling actually change the outcome of the election? That is to say, if there had been no Russian meddling, would Donald Trump still have won? We can't possibly know that. And, you know, it does seem unlikely that a lot of people would have actually changed their votes based on any of these posts. I mean, these are posts that are really playing on people's existing biases. So they're mm-hmm. not trying to convert Hillary Clinton voters into Donald Trump voters or vice versa. What they're trying to do is get both sides more angry at the other side and to sort of, you know, stoke the divisiveness that we already have in our political climate today, get people more riled up. Now, maybe that means more people show up at the polls, but it's hard to say exactly what the influence was on the election outcome.
Right. You're a tech reporter. You're not a political scientist, but it is kind of interesting how they did approach all of this. The companies want to be sure that they're considered technology companies, not media companies. That was an issue that came up. What's the significance of that?
Yeah, this is a debate that's been going on for quite a while now, and it's only been getting more intense. This is very important to social media platforms like Facebook and Twitter, because as technology companies, as long as they're perceived as just these sort of neutral technology platforms that anybody can use, then they have a very low level of responsibility for what gets posted on their site. So as long as Facebook is not in the business of deciding what content is okay, as long as they're not in the business of publishing content, then they can get away with saying, well, look, we're just the tool, we're just the platform, and, you know, if somebody posts bad stuff on here, then you can take it up with them, not us. If, on the other hand, these companies were to acknowledge that they play a role in shaping the content people see, that they play an active role, that their biases come into play in deciding what sort of news we're exposed to or what opinions we're exposed to, then, you know, you can make the argument that it becomes incumbent on them to actually take some responsibility when false information is posted or when people are using their platform to harass one another. And so it really comes down to the question of how much responsibility they bear for the content on their platforms.
Is Congress looking to directly address those issues?
It's not clear exactly what Congress is going to directly address, except that we do know there is a new bill. It's called the Honest Ads Act, I believe. And that was something that came up at the hearings. The idea is that Congress is looking to specifically regulate political advertisements on social media platforms, which historically have not been regulated in the same way as political advertisements purchased on television or in print or in other media. Now, the tech companies are pushing back against this. They were asked at the hearings, will you support this legislation? They declined to commit to that because they would prefer what they call self-regulation. They say, look, you know, you guys don't need to get involved, Congress. We will take care of this ourselves. We promise we'll do a better job. And as sort of a show of good faith, both Facebook and Twitter, right ahead of the hearings, announced that they have new policies requiring advertisers to disclose who they are. If they're political advertisers on Facebook, Facebook is actually now going to go and try to verify their identity, not just take their word for it that they're, you know, that they're from Texas and not Russia. So they are already taking real steps in this direction, but it's clear why they're doing it. It's because they want to be able to continue to run their businesses as they see fit. And a lot of their success as tech companies over the years has come from this hands-off attitude in Washington that's just let them do their thing.
I'm confused about how they can really achieve this if Russia knows that they know how they were doing it the last time. They'll just switch tactics the next time.
Well, yeah.
Can't they just shapeshift?
Yeah, I mean, probably. And we don't know how yet, but I think that's one of the big things, one of the big issues that's coming to light in the technology industry in general these days, is that whenever you have these systems, these automated systems like Facebook's newsfeed or like Google's search engine operating on a massive scale where decisions about what can be posted and what people see are made not by human employees of these companies, but rather by software algorithms that their engineers have built, there are going to be ways to game those systems. There are going to be people who exploit them. There was a story that came out just yesterday or just this past weekend about people exploiting YouTube Kids, the kids video service on YouTube, to show really creepy or weird or algorithmically generated content to kids. And it's they're taking advantage of the algorithm. So whenever you don't have human oversight, there are going to be ways to game the system. The tech companies want to say, well, we'll address these as they come up. You know, we'll fix them. We'll patch these holes. I think you're going to start to see more of an attitude among the public and among regulators of, well, you know, these problems are inevitable. Just as you said, I mean, these problems are going to keep coming up, and maybe we do need regulation here and not just to trust these companies to address each problem one by one retroactively.
You know, in some countries, it's really interesting, not as wealthy of countries as the United States, but they're starting to teach high school classes, required classes, to start teaching kids how to spot fake news and spot these fake ads.
Yeah, that's right. And in fact, I think we're even seeing in the United States. I don't know that it's you know, it's certainly not universal yet, but I hear stories all the time of classrooms where teachers are working on media literacy now. Mm-hmm. It's becoming clear that the ability to distinguish credible news sources from fake news or from misleading information or from propaganda is going to be crucial to citizenship in the 21st century in a way that maybe it wasn't as maybe it wasn't as hard to do when the media were controlled by corporations and by larger sort of established companies. Now that anybody can show any kind of news to anyone, it really is critical that people develop better critical thinking capacities.
Will Aramis, thanks for joining us. Always appreciate your time.
Thanks, Ann.
Will Aramis, tech writer for Slate. He's got a new podcast out now from Slate. It's entitled If Then. Check it out. More Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. As more and more technology makes its way into classrooms, tech companies are competing to gain a foothold for those lucrative deals with school districts. Those deals can mean hundreds of millions of dollars in sales and invaluable exposure of their brand to tens of thousands of students. New York Times reporter Natasha Singer recently wrote about how Silicon Valley is cozying up to school leadership with their hands on the purse strings. We'll have a link to her article on our website at wosu.org/allsides. Natasha Singer joins us now by phone. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
How big is the public school market for Silicon Valley?
Well, it's expected to reach about $21 billion in the next few years.
And because computers being what they are, there'll be constant churn over the years.
Yes. I mean, I think there's two things. One is there is immediate revenue from all these computers and apps that are going into schools. But also, if you get the students young and you get them on your Google operating system or your Microsoft operating system, those students may likely be long-term customers for the rest of their lives. And so it's the long tail also that's sort of a key motivation for tech companies.
The budding relationships between districts and tech companies was compared to that of pharmaceutical companies and doctors. Tell us why.
Well, we're doing a group of stories called Education Disrupted, and they're all about different Silicon Valley influence techniques. And this story particularly focused on how tech companies are influencing superintendents. And it was just reminiscent because, you know, I used to cover the pharmaceutical industry, right? I used to cover Johnson & Johnson and Merck. And those companies tapped certain doctors who were experts and sort of elevated them and flew them around the country to speak at conferences and paid them to speak and wined and dined them. And they were called key opinion leaders, and pharmaceutical companies used them to try to influence how other doctors were prescribing. And so what we see here with tech companies is they're selecting certain high-profile superintendents whose districts are really tech-happy and who are investing tens of millions or hundreds of million dollars in computers, laptops, apps. And they are not directly paying for these superintendents, but they're getting tech industry-backed groups or tech industry conferences to cover their travel expenses, and then they're invited to speak at conferences about how great their school's technology makeovers are going. And the most fascinating thing, though, was we found that there's this industry of firms, private companies, that tech companies can pay to get private meetings with superintendents. And there are a handful of them, and it ranges from, you know, a company can pay $50,000 to have a private dinner with a handful of superintendents from leading districts, or there's a group called the Educational Research and Development Institute, ERDI, and several times a year it arranges these big 2 or 3 day events where several dozen superintendents will be flown in and put up in hotels. And there are breakfast, lunches, and dinners with vendors, you know, companies that make math apps, companies that make reading apps, companies that make 3D printers for schools. And those companies can put in a request list of the superintendents they want to meet with, and then they have what they call panels, which are meetings of one company and their executives with, say, 5 superintendents of their choice. And they get product feedback from those superintendents. And they discuss other things with those superintendents. And we found that then superintendents went back to their school districts, and school districts ended up increasing their contracts with those companies.
Is this legal?
Well, the argument from the tech companies is we're paying this private company. We're not directly paying the superintendents. The superintendents may be getting paid $2,000, you know, to have these private meetings with tech companies, but they're not being paid by the tech companies. And so I interviewed a professor at Stanford who's a political scientist and also directs an ethics center there.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, if the benefits are flowing in both directions, with payments from schools going to education vendors and then dinner and travel going to school leaders, he called it a pay-for-play arrangement.
Yeah, absolutely. Your piece focused on schools, a school district in Baltimore, Maryland. How are students and teachers using technology in the classrooms there?
We focused on Baltimore County Public Schools, which is right outside the city of Baltimore. It's the 25th largest school district in the United States. And we focused on them because they have a particularly ambitious technology makeover plan. The idea was to give a laptop to each child from first grade up. And they started with the younger grades. Often school districts will start, you know, with high school down. Well, they started with elementary school up. And so we visited classrooms, and you see first graders, and they, you know, have a reading assignment, and they will record themselves reading with their laptops. And then they'll play the recordings back to see what words they stumbled on, and then their teachers will check it out. So there are quite interesting uses of technology in the school district, but there's also these quite interesting relationships between the school district and its vendors. So the minute the Baltimore County Schools decided that they were going to buy a laptop per child and signed up to spend $205 million on HP computers, Then Silicon Valley kicked into gear promoting the school district as like a model of technology adoption. And like computers had gone into 10 schools in a few grades, right? Mm-hmm. So nobody knew whether it was going to be beneficial or not, but already like HP invited the superintendent to speak at a high profile education conference in New York, and HP went around the world to like Rwanda saying, wow, you should use Baltimore County as your model of technology adoption. And then Microsoft gave the district a school, and Intel, whose chips were in the devices, gave the district an award. And so you see that
they're being groomed.
They're
like predators who are growing.
Well, they're being cultivated as models that other school districts should aspire to, but they're also, you know, being used to, you know, suggest to other districts, you should try this too. And so you see certain products being passed from district to district signing up for certain companies and brands because, you know, the model district did it. And so I'd like, it actually raises a really important question, right? It's not just there's the appearance of very heavy influence and marketing. Mm-hmm. It raises the question for students, right, who only get one chance at a public education that's free. Are the best and most effective technologies getting into the classroom, or are the best and most heavily promoted technologies getting into the classroom? And I think it's a really important question.
Well, what do we know? What is the evidence that using more technology in the classroom in the first place improves student performance, let alone whether you've got the right technology or the right company doing business with you?
Okay, so right now we have a whole lot of hype and a whole lot of hope mm-hmm. that technology is going to improve academic educational outcomes. And we have almost no evidence that it's academically beneficial. However, we also have an argument that technology is everywhere and kids should have access to laptops so that they learn how to search. And as you said in the previous segment, you know, they learn how to distinguish actual reliable sources from fake sources. You know, there are reasons that, you know, technology is useful in the classroom and important for students to know how to use. But that is a completely different question from should math and English and foreign languages and all this other stuff be learned primarily through software? Because we have no evidence that that actually is going to improve students' understanding or students' grades or students' test scores. We don't have any rigorous evidence that it's improving education itself.
Is anyone collecting evidence to show that or to the contrary?
You know, there are certain studies being done. There was a very sort of considered study done by the RAND Corporation on personalized learning, which is the idea of kind of trying to use computers to customize education to each student, mm-hmm. and they found mixed results. There was a study done at West Point, so higher education in college, which was rigorous. It was randomized, right? So they had one group that was randomly chosen to not use any technology in a class, and another group that was told they could use as much technology as they wanted, and a third group that was allowed to use tablet devices but only on their desks, like flat. And it turned out the students that used no technology did better in this course than the other groups that used technology. Now, that is in higher education, and that is West Point, which is a particularly motivated subset of students.
Mm-hmm.
So we can't necessarily extrapolate, but it's kind of startling that, in fact, even in a motivated group of students, the technology was detrimental to the results.
How widespread are these type of technology deals across the country? I mean, I know that Ohio State is getting into a big deal with Apple, for instance. You know, there are every incoming freshman, I think beginning next fall, will get their own tablet or laptop or something. So it's moving into higher ed as well.
Yes. I mean, we chose to focus on public schools because you have much younger students
mm-hmm.
and they have less or almost no agency, right? They don't have a choice. Things are being enacted upon them.
Mm-hmm.
And so we decided to look first at K through 12, but certainly the same kind of influence techniques that are being used in public schools are being used in higher ed.
I mean, I kind of see if a kid's gone through a public school and they're using a certain kind of technology, that might decide where they go to college. Depending on what kind of deal the college has. I mean, if you've been using Apple all your life, are you going to go to a college that's not using Apple?
Well, but it may be in many colleges now, you bring your own device, right? So it may not necessarily affect your choice of college, but it may certainly affect the kind of device you're going to buy for yourself or your family will
yeah.
buy for you, or you save up to buy or whatever to take with you to college. And it may influence whatever device you use for the rest of your life.
Are there concerns that resources spent on computers and tablets and that kind of a thing could be better spent elsewhere, or things are going not are going undone because of these huge resources? And it is, you know, I know Maryland County is a very big district, but still, that's a lot of money.
Yes. In Baltimore County, you know, I watched the school board meetings every other week for close to a year. And meeting after meeting, you would see parents step up and say, My child's school is building is falling apart, right? The water is running brown in the taps, or the, you know, bathrooms are having backup problems and sewage is flowing right across the hallways. Or my schools are so overcrowded that my kid has a classroom in an outside trailer, but he's not allowed to get his coat in the winter to go from the school building to the trailer. Or the schools are so overcrowded that some kids are scheduled to have lunch at 10 a.m. Or many schools don't have air conditioning and kids are just getting overheated in the summer. And, like, you know, we school board meeting after school board meeting, you're hearing parents get up and say, like, you're directing all this resources to technology. And, like, students with special needs, there's not enough staff for them. There's homeless kids, there's not enough social workers for them. And parents have made the argument that, like, maybe every first grader didn't need a $1,500 laptop. Maybe, you know, Chicago Public Schools has carts of Chromebooks, which are very inexpensive Google mm-hmm. devices, and they roll them from classroom to classroom.
Mm-hmm.
And so you don't necessarily have to have one expensive device per child. You could have a situation where a cart of computers were shared between two or three classrooms and used as needed. So that was one of the arguments the parents had made in Baltimore County, that they felt that there was kind of extreme focus on the latest technologies and a lack of focus on other things.
How did school officials respond?
To the parents?
Yeah.
Well, some schools that are falling apart are getting redone, and there are beginning to be new schools, but some schools feel completely left out, and so they have been complaining that they are not getting the resources they need. We'll see. I think it's going to be an ongoing debate, and there is now the superintendent who signed off on these huge technology expenditures has resigned, and there's a new interim superintendent.
Is that because of questions about conflict of interest?
The superintendent did not give a reason for resigning. However, in the months after he resigned, some school board members reported that they'd been interviewed by the Maryland State Prosecutor about the relationship the superintendent had with a company that was a school vendor. That vendor was not a technology company. So it's unclear what happened with the previous superintendent. The question is whether the current interim superintendent is going to continue this whole hog technology makeover or shift priorities and address some of the major issues the parents have been bringing up, like safety of students and discipline and overcrowding.
Are you seeing questions about the ethics of these deals, whether or not there's enough oversight popping up around the country at all?
You know, we're seeing it from people who are ethicists, like biomedical ethicists, who are watching this and have seen this in big pharma. Okay. But what was completely fascinating was when I went to the school district and said, you know, how do you respond to these ethical issues? Because both the previous superintendent and the current interim superintendent have gone to these events where companies pay to have these small meetings with superintendents, and mm-hmm. they've participated. And I said, how do you respond to these ethics questions? And they said, we don't think there's any conflict of interest. And then we said, okay, has the interim superintendent been paid? Because the previous superintendent was paid to meet with other companies. And the answer was, she did it on her vacation time and independently and has nothing to do with the school district. And it's like, well, if your superintendent is meeting privately with companies that are current or future school vendors, why doesn't the school district make public a list of the companies that superintendent has met with? You know, why say it's nothing to do with the school?
Right. This seems like no dust stuff to me.
Right. So I think we're going to see now school districts are going to go back to their superintendents and say, hey, what is this really about? You know, we agreed you could go, but we didn't actually understand what you were doing when you mm-hmm. were at these events. And I think we're going to see parents push back and demand that public school districts publish lists of which companies their superintendent has met with. And then when parents look at the contracts, they can see what happened. You know, and I think there will be a question of whether it is ethically appropriate for public school superintendents to go to be flown to events where they're meeting with potential or current school vendors and getting paid for it.
Very interesting, Natasha Singer. Thanks for joining us today to talk about it.
Thanks. It's always fun to be on with you. I really appreciate it.
We will have a link to Natasha Singer's story about how Silicon Valley is cozying up to school superintendents in the hopes of maybe selling them hundreds of millions of dollars, maybe billions of dollars in technology over the years. More Tech Tuesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. For decades, Star Wars fans have dreamed of doing battle with one of those glowing, buzzing lightsabers. Thanks to advances in augmented reality technology, those fans are a step closer to living out the fantasy of dueling as a Jedi Knight. Joining us to talk about that and other tech news is contributing editor at Android Central, Russell Holly. Did that music just kind of get your blood rushing? Russell?
No, Ann, because I've been listening to that music for an entire week now. I basically fell asleep to that earlier this week.
So it's called Star Wars Jedi Challenges. What do you need to play it? And, you know, how is it?
Well, so this is a headset, but, you know, unlike a virtual reality headset, it is transparent. You can see through it and see the real world and see people doing things on the other side of the headset, which is great because I have friends who like to take pictures of me when I have a headset on, more mockingly than anything else. It's
yeah,
just become
some,
a time-honored
yeah.
tradition now. So this, this is an augmented reality headset, but like some of the other virtual reality headsets, it relies on your phone for the computational brain. So you take your phone and you stick it in a cartridge that goes in the top of this headset, and it sort of projects the Star Wars universe onto the lens that's immediately in front of you. And so you have, instead of a game controller, you have a lightsaber. That lightsaber is primarily used for these recreations of fights with villains from the Star Wars universe. You can fight with the most recent Kylo Ren or Darth Vader or several others. And in doing so, you are put through this kind of extended game where there's a teaching character called the Archivist who is training you to become a Jedi Master. So you go mm-hmm. through all of these training exercises alongside fighting all of these other creatures and droids and stuff as you work your way up to eventually this kind of larger boss battle that you do at the end.
Can you train with Yoda?
You cannot train with Yoda. While there is a healthy selection of bad guys, the only other character that you see is this Archivist character. There are none of the other, quote-unquote good guys in any part of the training exercise, which was really kind of odd, especially from the perspective of this kind of game that they were taking you through where you're kind of training to become a Jedi Master.
Is it challenging to set all the components up?
No, so this relies on a single beacon that you set in front of you. It's really just a glowing ball. It has no special tricks or computers to it. It doesn't do anything other than glow in one of two colors depending on the environment that you're in. You set this thing in front of you as long as the room that you are in has about 3 feet of clearance on either side. Really, just whatever your arm's length is, so that you're not smacking into Dad's television or something. Then you have enough space to play this game, and you can see everything around you perfectly clearly. So even like in the heat of combat, when you're swinging way harder than you should be, there's a really low chance of you breaking something or someone.
Because it's not a real lightsaber, it's not going to blow anything up.
Right, and that's actually kind of the cool visual trick to this is that you're holding a lightsaber handle. It is kind of the lightsaber from the Star Wars universe, the most iconic of those lightsabers. And when you're playing the game, you hit the button on the side of the controller, and the augmented reality part kicks in, and you hear the lightsaber extend, and you see the beam extend from the controller that you're holding. So you're holding the sword out in front of you, and as far as the game is concerned, you now have the fully functioning lightsaber.
How does it feel?
They did a really good job. Disney and Lenovo did a really good job making it feel compelling. Obviously not real, but it was there's vibration motors in the handles that kind of pulse when your lightsaber clashes with something else.
Mm-hmm.
that helps feel very realistic. The sound that they provide, that there's very much as I teased in the beginning of this, very much the sounds of the Star Wars universe are surrounding you. You're being constantly mocked by the villains that you're fighting. And so they did a great job with that. And that's also one of three parts of this game that you can play. The lightsaber fight is obviously the most important part. But they've also recreated the Holo Chess game from the original Star Wars movie that fans have been kind of obsessed with forever. And there's a
from the bar scene or from is it a tavern scene or something?
No, it's on board the Millennium Falcon. There's a Holo Chess board.
That's right. Yeah,
on the Millennium Falcon. But yeah, so there's a full game with like 18 different levels that you can play through, against various opponents to see who is the weird creature battle chess master. But then there's also a battle simulation game where you look down and instead of an opponent that is the same height as you, you have a map, just this massive strategy map. And you lead rebel forces to take over the empire forces.
How are you doing?
So I have I've almost beaten the lightsaber challenges. It's it got really hard at a certain point. I kind of had to take a break because my son was watching. And so I reached that point in the game where like my default is to swear at whoever just beat me, but then I can actually see that my 9-year-old is sitting there watching me. So I have to demonstrate some restraint.
Exactly.
So the game is, they've done a lot to make it challenging for a lot of different skill levels, kids, every kid that I've put in this headset has had a lot of fun with it. And it has the same kind of visual safety warnings that any other virtual reality headset has. They prefer ages 13 and up, but kids that are under age 13 can play for short periods of time. The headset is not too heavy, so you can put it on. 9 years old is the youngest that I've gone, and it really doesn't matter what age you are. The first time you hit that lightsaber button and see the lightsaber pop up on the screen as though it's really there in front of you, has that same kind of jaw drop effect. Everyone really genuinely likes that part of the game.
Why do you think they went with augmented reality versus VR?
Well, I think virtual reality presents some challenges with safety in an environment like that.
Okay.
You are swinging this lightsaber pretty hard at some point. And so if you couldn't see what was in front of you, that gets pretty dangerous pretty quick.
Is it an athletic sort of game?
You definitely can, work up a sweat after a while. And I jokingly on Twitter said that playing this game for too long caused me to pull a leg muscle, which I felt for several days after.
Oh, you mean you really did pull one?
Oh, I did. Yeah. that was really funny.
Do they mock you? Do they know when you've done something like that or not?
No. But it's, you definitely have, kind of an athletic feel to that part of the game. And then obviously the strategy parts can even be played sitting down at a coffee table, really. It doesn't require much space at all for the other forms of the game.
What about the holo chess? Holo is short for hologram, right?
Yes.
What was that like?
Well, it's, everyone has seen that scene where Chewbacca is playing, but you never really get any idea of, how the game works or anything like that.
Yeah.
You just see one monster destroy another. And so this is one of the first kind of Star Wars experiences that I've had where they've kind of had to explain all of the rules to me. And so it was kind of cool. You choose a set of characters that are your chess pieces for lack of a better description, based on their respective abilities. And you go on this little chessboard, this circular chessboard against the AI player who has, its selection of monsters, and whoever has the best strategy or the most overwhelming force has won the day.
How much does it cost, and is it worth it?
This is $199. It's available in Best Buy stores now, and I definitely think it's worth it if you are any kind of Star Wars fan. You know, you look at just the cost of like replica lightsabers.
Mm-hmm.
They start at almost the same price. You know, the ones that light up and you know, the ones that really feel realistic in your hand, and they're like between $150 and $250, depending on the quality that you go for. And this is, you know, while not something you would hang up on a wall, infinitely more useful from my perspective. You know, even as an unfortunate collector of nerd things, this is just a way more entertaining, you know, spending of $200 in one of those replica lightsabers.
Now, is this going to show up on your Christmas list for us later on this year?
You will absolutely hear me talk about this again.
All right. You also wanted to talk about one of Amazon's smart devices, the Echo Show. This is like the Amazon Echo speaker, but it has a screen.
Yes. So we've talked about this before. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, it's really kind of built for the kitchen, and it has, you know, a camera built into it so you can video chat with other people who own an Echo Show, or, you know, people who have a phone with the Alexa app on it. And one of the features, it's kind of a passive feature that happens all day long, like a screensaver almost, is it shows headlines for whatever is happening in the world. You know, the kind of news of the day that's happening in the world. Everyone in my house has walked past this thing, you know, a couple times in a week and caught a headline that they've never seen before, regardless of age, and been like, huh, I wonder what this is all about. And gone to get more information. It's a cool feature, you know, to kind of grab your attention and I guess kind of remind you that thing is there in the kitchen. But something that I've noticed, you know, we've had a lot of, you know, both, you know, kind of tragic and global and concerning news over the last week and a half. I don't know if you talk about that kind of thing here. None of it showed up on the Echo Show.
Really? So there's a question about what they're showing.
There's a real question about what it is that they're showing. You know, I started paying attention, you know, when the, you know, stories about, you know, Catalonia had happened. There was, you know, nothing showed up there on the Echo Show. And then, you know, when the Mueller indictments came out, there was nothing on the Echo Show. The last two, you know, really, you know, tragic mass shootings that we've had, neither showed up on the Echo Show.
Wow.
And it was really, it was almost understandable for Amazon to not have a kind of breaking news function where it shows up and says, hey, this thing is happening right now and it might be important.
Mm-hmm.
But those headlines, as near as I could tell, never showed up on the Echo Show. They weren't discussed at all, and were frequently instead replaced with you know, really kind of trivial things, like, you know, what Kanye West was up to.
Well, I was going to say, it sounds like did they default to entertainment? That is really interesting. Do you know why? I mean, or what kind, is it an algorithm they're using or what?
We've reached out to Amazon and haven't gotten an official answer, you know, as far as any of that stuff goes. So there's a lot of speculation as to why this is happening.
Interesting.
It's not that there's no, you know, kind of
hard
important
news
information to show up there, because, you know, we have seen headlines about, for example, the Paradise Papers have shown up on there.
Huh.
You know, so it's not that no kind of information of that nature, you know, be it political or worldly or something like that, shows up here. It just definitely takes a backseat to, you know, why a stadium went vegan because a pop star was there. You know, or you know, something like that. Just a lot of really kind of you know, passive light stories take precedent over these kind of global or national events. And that was a really odd. It really feels like a decision that Amazon made when continuing to populate this newsfeed.
But we don't know why.
Right, and that's especially confusing because Amazon, the Echo service, all of the Amazon Echo services has a newsfeed system that you say, you know, Alexa, tell me the news from today, and it will read off headlines from a huge selection of news sources, and will every time tell you if there's, you know, kind of breaking news about something that's happening in the world. And, you know, in my testing of it, absolutely mentioned things like the Mueller indictments or you know, the things happening in Catalan. You know, it was really interesting to see that, you know, when I asked specifically for news, you know, the Echo Alexa service, you know, would tell me about these important things, but as kind of a passive background service, Amazon seems to be intentionally choosing kind of lighter stories to show you.
Interesting. Very interesting. Is there any way to control, besides asking Alexa to tell you what the news headlines are, is there any other way to control the types of news you see?
Not for this in particular. The Echo show is kind of unique in that it's the only one right now with a display.
Yeah.
And so that's it's really kind of a passive background thing that doesn't have a lot of controls to it. But it may be something that Amazon introduces over time and gives you some control there.
All right. In other Amazon news, the online retailer has opened up the Retro Zone section on its site. What is that for?
I think this is entirely hilarious because we on a regular basis talk about how this new gadget or this new thing has come out, and it's really kind of like poking at the people who really enjoy nostalgia and reaching into their wallets. And apparently enough of those things have come out that Amazon is giving it an entire category on its website for buying things. Retro Zone is entirely focused on those kind of nostalgia products, you know, tech focused or clothing or you know, things that you would hang in your house, you know, really just kind of runs the gamut. And so it's all in its own category now, you know, that they're calling the Retro Zone. And that really just kind of struck me as kind of a peek to how much nostalgia we are leaning on as a culture right now.
Is it nostalgia from a certain year or
you know,
decade
in
or something?
Most of these things, it kind of tends to lean almost like Stranger Things towards kind of the early 80s.
Which was, to me, the dorkiest time on the planet Earth, but that was my coming-of-age time. I just can't believe how stupid it was. But yeah, but then I look back on Stranger Things, and I don't know. I think they're pretty realistic, but there is an appeal to it.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a charm to it, and it definitely seems to kind of, everything kind of, you know, emanates from that point. So, you know, we'll get some that's a little bit further back and some that's a little further forward, and occasionally we'll get kind of leaning into the 90s, you know, for things like that recent re-release of Surge Cola and stuff like that.
Exactly. So as far as what they're selling, well, the page is also selling an app called Stranger Things, the game. Is that, you know, a thing?
Yeah. So this is it's a game that's designed to look like a you know, 16-bit Nintendo game that you can get on Amazon devices as well as any Android phone or iPhone. I think it's like a $4 game that you can get. And it's, you know, it walks you through the Stranger Things universe. You can play as a bunch of different characters and it gets pretty difficult at some point, actually. I got distracted with it on a plane flight from San Jose and ended up playing it for almost 7 hours.
Oh, my God, Russell. Okay. We've only got a minute left, but before I let you go, I got to ask you, what are people saying about the iPhone X or the iPhone 10 or whatever you call it?
Early reviews say that it is, you know, very positive. The screen is really pretty, but very, very few of Apple's apps are formatted to really take advantage of kind of that taller, longer screen. So things look really awkward in a lot of places right now. But you can distract yourself from that by turning your face into an animated poop and talking at people.
Okay. Good to know. And how much is that costing again? It's about the same.
$1,000.
An even thousand, you know. I mean, it's painless when you think about it that way versus anything else. There is a lot. So the Animoji is what you're talking about there?
Yeah, the Animoji. And there's a bunch of different Animoji that have come from. And there's actually been some really clever things to have come from that. Someone recreated, you know, a couple of music videos where all of the characters are singing as, you know, as the different Animoji, and it ended up being really cute the way that it was done. So there are some fun things happening with it. But man, the frequency with which some of the people in my Twitter feed rely on that poop emoji is just a little high for my taste. Really says a lot about my friends.
Yeah, really, it really, really, really does. It's just, of course, what does it say about you to spend 7 hours?
Exactly.
There's so much is revealed in this program every Tuesday with Russell Holly. Russell, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
Russell Holly, contributing editor at Android Central. That's it for Tech Tuesday today. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.